You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Free Speech, Free Minds, Free Markets by Tara Smith.
Freedom of speech has received a great deal of attention in the past few years worldwide, in popular discussion as well as in the academy. It's been under attack, both in practice, in governments banning and punishing speech, in violent protests of speakers that style themselves counter-speech, and by theorists who develop explanations of why we should restrict so-called hate speech, for instance, or speech that challenges some orthodoxy about race or gender. Whether on American college campuses or in China or Turkey or Venezuela or France or Great Britain or Canada, and I could go on, this long-standing pillar of a free, civilized society has been under siege. Now, many aspects of these free speech debates bear discussion, and many objectivist intellectuals have written or spoken often eloquently on a lot of these different issues. Within this vast territory, my focus this afternoon is on one particular fact that hasn't gotten much attention: the relationship between freedom of speech and freedom of markets, property, trade, economic liberty. I'm using all of those roughly interchangeably, okay? People usually think of speech as among our civil liberties: free press, freedom of religion, the right to vote, to be tried by jury, and property, money, as in another category, another department of life. But it's a mistake to compartmentalize these. They aren't two completely different phenomena, and we can't fully understand the meaning of either apart from the other. So let me put it a little bit differently. Speech isn't important only for those who are interested in political issues, those who want to attend their city council meetings or influence government policy at whatever level, or important for artists who want to perform their plays or write their poetry. It's important to businessmen, to a property owner, to anybody who simply wants to make a living. Now, here I can't go into the complete case for the relationship between free speech and free markets, but I call attention to it because a keener appreciation of how the two are symbiotic will enrich our understanding of what's at stake in these speech debates swirling around us, and of how important it is to fight for every ounce of freedom, speech freedom and market freedom. So just a word on the title of the talk: Free Speech, Free Minds, Free Markets. Free minds. That's really the bridge here. Properly understood, what we refer to as free speech actually protects free thinking. And thinking is critical to material prosperity, to the production of goods and services, to making wealth, property, your right to property. So also, just a preliminary at the outset, about terminology or the scope of what I'm speaking of. Freedom of speech is a legal concept. It concerns how the legal system should treat people's speech. I'm not talking about wider issues, and this is often confused because in just common parlance, people will refer to freedom of speech when they're talking about the policies of a Facebook, for instance, right? I'm not talking about the activities, restrictive or not restrictive, of a corporation, a university, a private organization or institution, such as Facebook or the Red Cross or the Boy Scouts or the NCAA or the Roman Catholic Church, right? There are reasons why some of those sorts of institutions should also adopt very open policies, be very welcoming of a variety of opinions. And there are reasons why some of those shouldn't. That's going to depend on their missions and their agendas. But those are different questions from the question of freedom of speech, which is, should certain speech be against the law? Should you be legally free to say what you like, or should you have to adhere to the strictures of government on that? Okay. So the handout. You've got an outline that I will track to a considerable extent such that you can follow along. And then I've got a few passages on there which I will call attention to when they're relevant. And on the back, I've listed just a few reading recommendations. I could have gone into many more, but I'm happy to tell you a little bit more about some of these if anybody's interested in the Q&A. Or we can just talk about Austin. I can sing its praises for a long time. You can do that too. Okay. Believe it or not, free speech has many defenders. Notwithstanding all the attacks on it in recent years, all the calls for curbing speech that's offensive or oppressive, there are voices who defend and the freedom of controversial airs to be voiced, to be entertained, even on college campuses. A lot of academics defend freedom of speech, and a lot of law professors, a lot of deans, a lot of people of real stature in the academy, people who usually have clout. But they're losing. They're failing. Their efforts to defend speech are failing. Calls for restrictions on speech are growing more common, more bold, more belligerent. And increasingly, they're being adopted, restrictions being implemented. We've got proposals in Congress with support, not surprisingly, from both sides of the aisle, right, for altering the First Amendment. And you just want to pause on that a second, right? Get that? Yes, for altering the First Amendment. Okay. I mean, you know, the amendments aren't written in stone or anything, but okay, we're going to alter the First Amendment so that the Congress can have control of political speech. You just want to get your head around that, right? And this is, you know, the emerging consensus that these sorts of things should be done. And many others, well, of course, they make concessions agreeing, well, of course, we shouldn't allow that vile speech or the people with that much money to say that, while still claiming to defend free speech. So we've been chipping away, despite the efforts of some to defend free speech. Why are even the defenders failing? Well, essentially, it's no surprise to you, I'm sure, to hear, because they've got the wrong arguments. They don't truly understand why speech should be free. The defense of it has been hobbled by misguided premises that play into the hands of those who would restrict speech. Historically, there are two broad kinds of bases that have been offered for freedom of speech, utilitarian and libertarian. You've got basically the social utility picture most associated with John Stuart Mill from the mid-19th century, appealing to the general welfare, society's well-being, the common good. Or you've got the individual liberty perspective most associated with John Locke, a little bit before him, John Milton. The idea that your life is yours. The first view, the utilitarian view, says, you know, it's really useful. It's beneficial to everyone that you enjoy free speech, and that's why you should have it. It fosters the social welfare, the common good. The second approach, the more individual approach, says, whether it's useful or not to society, that's not the basis that justifies your claim to free speech. Rather, your life is yours, to do with as you like, to spend however you like, including by speaking if you want to speak or write, right? As long as you don't impinge on the like rights of others. But as long as you respect that, speaking is simply among the many, many things that you are rightfully entitled to do. Now again, this is painting with a little bit of a broad brush, but these are the two basic alternative positions on the foundations of freedom of speech. Which of these is dominant today? Which is most prevalent? It isn't even close. In a landslide, decidedly the utilitarian position. Its most frequent form, certainly in the US, is to appeal to democracy as being served by freedom of speech. It's good for us as a community. A healthy civil society requires the open exchange of ideas. These are the sorts of appeals that you hear repeatedly. We need an informed electorate for taking care of society, but it's always in terms of what's going to be good for the group, for the social welfare. This emerges in, for instance, in debates about campaign finance regulations, press freedom, the current push to regulate social media, right? It's bad for society if people get to say these things or what have you, okay? Now, something to notice here, because I think it's potentially confusing. And I think it leads a lot of people who are inclined to defend liberty to get more in bed with Mill on this than they should. Okay, so let's point out. These two frameworks, as I've presented them, They're not mutually incompatible in what they observe in the facts that they purport. What I mean is this. John Locke is correct that the individual is entitled to speak as part and parcel of his right to do all sorts of things, his right to his life, right? And Mill is also correct that respecting that right to speak will be tremendously beneficial to everyone, that we all stand to benefit. I definitely agree with him on that. But they're not compatible as bottom line rationales, as the justification of the right to free speech. And free speech has been losing for decades because we've steadily replaced the Lockean, Enlightenment, individualistic framework with the utilitarian public welfare framework. It's crucial to appreciate that under a utilitarian outlook, speech isn't truly a right at all. It's a permission, granted only when it is useful to central command. And you will enjoy it only as long as you have something useful to say, honey. Useful according to the rulers, what our governors deem socially beneficial, right? Register that. That's really what you get on the utilitarian picture, right? And you want to be alert to how that can distort some of the debate over economic liberty and those material issues that we're going to get to, okay? So let's turn next to the question, what do speech rights have to do with property rights? Speaking freedom with economic freedom, markets, capitalism, material affairs. So this is number 3 on the handout if you're following. What do speech rights have to do with property rights? Everything. Let me start here by just giving you some examples where material freedom and speaking freedom are naturally entwined with one another. And then from there, we'll ascend to a more principled perspective on why freedom of speech is critical to property, okay? But I'm going to start with some examples of economic rights intersecting with speech rights. And these are in no particular order. It's really just an assortment of cases where business interests, if you want to call them that, overlap with speech interests, where business utilizes speech. You've got to speak to advertise your business, whatever kind of business, right? It's a dry cleaners, it's the newest geek squad in town, you're running a back-to-school special at your stationary goods store, you've got a sale at the shoe store, you want to advertise the farmer's market downtown on Saturday mornings. You need speech to describe your specific product, its advantages over the competitors, the rates you charge, the reliability of your service, the support teams available. Many occupations employ speaking at the heart of what they do, the service they provide. Look at, like, me, right? Teachers, professors, what do for a living? We do a lot of talking, right? We talk, we lecture, we write, we publish. But it's not only people in education fields and all the levels of education. Therapists, psychiatrists, marriage counselors, life coaches, many clergymen, people who give dietary advice, professionally, people who they go to give dietary advice, people who counsel you in the right meditation techniques, investment guidance, retirement planning, lawyers advise clients, tour guides, right? Have a tour the history of Charleston, South Carolina, or take ghost tours in New Orleans. The point is simply, in many, many fields, speaking is at the center of the service provided. Or consider ratings agencies, watchdog organizations, and the like, that will track and evaluate others' actions or others' performances, right? They might try to help you figure out the relative merits of these different colleges based on these 6 measures. They might try to evaluate refrigerators or cars or the virtues of an Android versus some other kind of phone and so on, right? It goes on. Think about physicians who advise, they're not just tapping your knees, right? They're advising patients about treatment options or about the effects of various diets or activities on their blood pressure or the susceptibility to this kind of illness or skin cancer or the benefits of vaccines or what have you, right? Doctors write prescriptions for medications. Think about drug companies and what they're required to say on packaging. They also, of course, have the advertising issues, but also what our government requires them to put on the packaging. But it's not only drug companies, ditto cigarette companies and liquor companies and many, many other products. I mean, you can't buy a mattress without being warned about, you know, I don't know what, but maybe I've, I mean, have I, like, are there a lot of mattress accidents that I've missed? But, you know, but they've got you covered. Okay, it's nice to know, right? Food products, what a farmer can call organic is government regulated, whether you can sell your skim milk as skim, whether a butcher can call his meat halal, and so on. But going to a fairly different realm, think about campaign finance restrictions. Now, at first glance, you think, well, wait, that's political speech. It's not economic. But such restrictions do restrict spending money, material resources, and whether it's private individuals who wish to give to candidates or large corporations who wish to do so, their reasons are often economic, right? A lot of people vote their pocketbook. You think, gee, that candidate supports these policies on minimum wage mandates or these changes to the medical insurance requirements that I would have to give my employees. His stand on tariffs or that tax deduction will affect me. His stand on immigration policy will affect whether I can hire the kinds of very technically or technologically educated workers who I need, or et cetera. I don't need to fill in all the blanks for you guys, right? We often think of candidates, he'd be good for business, bad for business. The point is simply people engage in political speech and try to influence the government because the government affects them, their material condition, as well as their civil liberties, freedom of religion, due process, those sorts of things. So the upshot from all the examples, these examples, is simply that economic freedom and speech freedom are naturally intertwined. How we speak and how free we are to speak directly affects our economic condition. The implication thus far is that freedom of speech touches on a lot of activities, even those we would initially think somewhat afield of its concerns. Why is that? Why is the reach of free speech so vast, its breadth so widely encompassing? And the answer here, I think, can be found if we think about the First Amendment a little bit. So I've put the First Amendment on the handout, and I'll read it now. Let's look at that to see what speech is really about. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. There are five elements in there. The amendment's scope, its concern, is wider than just speech. Free speech is only one of those other elements, religion, press, and so on. Now, what do these five have in common? And this is a theme that Ankar Gatte has been speaking of for several years now, right? Well, what do they have in common? Basically, they're intellectual activities, as contrasted with physical or material movements. Thinking, writing, praying, petitioning, publishing, activities of the press, even assembling. That concerned gathering to express a belief, such as that a law is unjust, that a policy should be changed. Even the right to assembly, that was not about bodies, physical activity. They didn't sneak that in there because they wanted to get together on Sunday mornings to toss horseshoes or to build a barn or something like that. It was assembly to make a point, to convey an idea about, for instance, the rights of slaves, or that women should be given the vote, right? This was really important, especially when you didn't have the social media and other kinds of communications that we have today. People had to get together to make their voices known in impactful, potentially impactful ways. Okay. So why would the Constitution do that, safeguard intellectual freedom? Why might it make sense to separate these, to call attention to these in particular and say, hands off, as the First Amendment does? So this is number 5 on the handout. Well, one aspect of the answer is historical, bitter experience. The founders' forebears in Holland, England, other parts of Europe often suffered religious and political persecution for their ideas, their beliefs, right? Many lived under state churches, the crushing of criticism of popes or monarchs, for instance. John Locke had to flee England for a while because of his political opinions. Also, relations between the colonists and the British monarch, clashes over taxes imposed by Parliament, the belief often that the colonists didn't get to speak their side, didn't get to petition. So there's a lot more to be said, but one whole component of, and one kind of explanation here is historical. Philosophically, the case is even more interesting and more what we're interested in. Philosophically, there's a two-part reason, I think. Intellectual activity's inability to infringe on others' rights and the value of the mind. These are the primary reasons why it makes sense for the First Amendment in our system of government to separate and call special attention to these intellectual activities. So let me explain each of these, and this is really the heart of what I'm talking about this afternoon. One background point here. I am presupposing a basic picture of government that is implicit in our Constitution, the idea that the government is to protect individuals' rights, individuals' liberty. That is its mandate, that is its mission, its function, its sole function. Witness the Declaration of Independence. It is to protect these rights that governments are instituted among men. The legal system on this view is to do everything necessary to protect individual rights from assault, and it is only to do that which is necessary to accomplish that. Okay, so that's the basic background picture I'm presupposing here. Now, given that overarching framework, how would intellectual activities fit under it? How should they be treated under a government that's based on that principle? They should be left free, left alone. Why? Because intellectual activities as such cannot infringe on others' rights. One person's thinking cannot take anything away from other people. Let's concretize that, right? Thinking. What are some of the kinds of things you're doing when you're thinking? Well, he thinks, he ponders, doubts, questions. I mean, these are forms of thinking, right? Ponders, doubts, questions, disputes, challenges. Whether he's doing this out loud or with himself on paper or just in his own mind, this is thinking. Ruminates, reflects, wonders, speculates, explains, generates examples, mounts arguments, draws inferences, concludes, reaches decisions. These activities are essentially mental. But again, my claim a moment ago was one person's thinking, doing any of these sorts of things, right? One person's thinking cannot take anything away from other people. It does not render their lives in any way less theirs, theirs to rule as they like, which is what their rights entitle them to, the freedom to do that. This is reflected in a well-known observation of Thomas Jefferson, which I've also put on the handout. He observed, it does me no injury. It does me no injury for my neighbor to say that there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. He's getting at the same basic point that I am in that, right? What goes on in my head can't twist your arm. Even my expressing what I'm thinking can't make anyone else agree with what I say. Believe it, adopt it, act on it. My thinking or speaking or writing simply doesn't have the power to move your muscles. Now, you know, true confessions. I hope to be an effective speaker, right? I want influence. I want to make people think, and depending on what I'm talking about and who I'm talking to, in many cases, I want them to revise their pre-existing beliefs. But whether or not that actually happens is not in my power. It depends on what I say and what a given person who hears me chooses to do, how he regards what I say, what he thinks of it, how he appraises it, and whether he then chooses to act on it. Contrast. When I engage in physical activity, I can affect your body whether you like it or not, right? Regardless of audience cooperation. I don't need anything on your part for my blade to draw blood, my bullet to make you buckle. But intellectual activities cannot, by themselves, take anything from others that is theirs, again. Now, I emphasize, by themselves, intellectual activities, right? There are special circumstances when a person's speech, along with certain other elements, elevate it to the level of infringing on others' rights. There are circumstances in which speech can become more potent. For example, cases of reckless endangerment, leaking classified information that compromises national security or endangers the safety of certain individuals, knowingly fraudulently misrepresenting your product. There are special cases. I'm going to bracket those for now, and that's why I say intellectual activities in and of themselves, apart from such special circumstances. But the fact, the larger point here, remains intellectual activities are different in kind from physical. And they're different in the one respect that the government has reason to care about, namely their relationship to others' rights, to others' freedom. So to essentialize the answer thus far to the question that I had posed, which was, why should the First Amendment treat intellectual activities differently from others? It's because intellectual activities can't violate others' freedom. The reason, in other words, stems from the function of government. Because intellectual activities of themselves can't threaten rights, they are prima facie off limits to government restriction. Okay. So you can see what I mean when I said I do need to, like, you have to use your mind a little bit. This is not the easiest material. Now, a few minutes ago, in explaining why the Constitution puts intellectual freedom in a special category, I noted two reasons. Let me now elaborate on the second, the value of the mind. And this is 5B on the handout. And this, I hope, will make even clearer the importance of speech in the economic realm. So the value of the mind. An important question to have in mind here is, why is freedom valuable? Not as an end in itself. Not because, a lot of people like it or want it. Not because they think they're entitled to it. Freedom is valuable because it is a necessary condition of human beings being able to live, of their being able to think rationally and act accordingly. Accordingly is important here. It's only action that is guided by reason, by logical inference, from observed reality, from fact, that can enable man to meet his needs. Therefore, the ability to reason, and more broadly, to think, is crucial. When we erect a government and charge it with the assignment of protecting individuals' rights, we mustn't lose sight of the reason why that is valuable. And essentially, the reason is so that man can reason and thereby prosper. In a sense, freedom of the mind is the first freedom, or the particular kind of freedom that makes the rest valuable. Get this. Freedom of action without freedom of mind is no good. It's useless, right? Freedom of action without freedom of mind is no good, useless. Because action without reason is no good, is of no value. Action without reason is pointless at best, at worst, destructive. If a government protected people's actions, but not their ability to reason about their actions, it wouldn't do a damn bit of good. The larger thought is, intellectual freedom is what makes physical freedom worth having. The mind, the mental activity of reasoning, is what enables a person's physical activities to be constructive, to be genuinely, objectively valuable. Consider the fact that natural resources, as we refer to them, Natural resources alone do not satisfy our needs. This is a point familiar to this audience, right? As Steven Pinker put it, quote, humanity does not suck resources from the earth like a straw through a milkshake, close quote. I mean, it's a nice image from Pinker. We satisfy our needs, he writes, and here I'm sort of mixing quote and paraphrase just to make the prose, the English flow grammatically. So, but this is basically more Pinker. He says, we satisfy our needs through ideas, recipes, formulas, techniques, blueprints, and algorithms for manipulating the physical world to give us what we're after, to give us what we need. Right? Okay, that's the Pinker. So again, my claim. It's the mental activity of reasoning that enables a person's physical activities to be worthwhile. Correspondingly, the preservation of that activity's freedom is of paramount importance. Because you can only reason about an issue when you are free to explore it, to consider novel suggestions, unusual hypotheses, criticisms, and the rest. One plain illustration of this is in the realm of business. So let's get back to business. Ideas drive successful businesses. The more sophisticated the product, the more that ideas are critical. Think about the intellectual power behind, and I mean here we have so many scores of examples to choose from, but think of the intellectual power behind eye surgery of different sorts, or hip replacements, or the internet, this vast, you know, to those of us who didn't grow up on it, amazingly speedy network of communications. Think about nanotech or CRISPR DNA technology, if that's even an appropriate way to refer to it, right? Think about the ultrasound they use to detect what's bubbling miles beneath the surface of the earth, right? By the way, I recommend one of the things on the handout, one of the reading recommendations, Don Watkins' essay, I think it's called Luck is Overrated, in the collection that he co-edited with Yaron Brook, Equality is Unfair. His piece on luck has some really good discussion of the issue of the role of the mind in successful businesses. And this is a theme, by the way, that Ed Locke hits upon, too, in work of his earlier on prime movers and leaders and businessmen. So again, I've just given you some examples of some fairly sophisticated, easy for me to say, yeah, fairly sophisticated advances, you know, material goods and services that we have thanks to the mind. But look, any business making even the simplest products must confront lots of obvious questions. Whether you're making bread or making buttons or you're a moving company, you're physically hauling furniture, those dangerous couches. I mean, let's talk about any old business that I can imagine, right? Okay, you want to start your own business, all right? What are you going to make? What are you going to offer? Who needs that? Why would anybody buy that? How are you going to make it? Why should people buy it? How is yours different from what's already on the market? How is it better? Are there any ways in which it's not better? Maybe it's worse in these respects, all right? Well, what are you going to say about that? How are you going to battle the perception that it isn't worth trying your product, right? To be viable, to have a good chance of success, you've got to answer these questions. You have to think. You have to gather information. What's been tried before? What's succeeded? What's failed? And why? What were the contributing factors there? And it's not always obvious to figure out the answers to these, right? You face still further questions. How are you going to advertise your product, your service? Which angles are you going to play up? Where are you going to advertise? What audiences should you try to reach? Same messages for all, or will you tailor it to different age cohorts or different economic brackets or different parts of town, right? How are you going to recruit the best workers? Who would be the best workers for your company, for what you're selling? What qualities are most worth having on your staff? How much money do you need to start and weather the early going, right? Where are you going to get the loan? Well, he's offering you those rates. His are stiffer, but he's a little bit more reliable in certain. You've got a lot to think about. I mean, we could go on, and we will, a little bit more, right? You're doing well. I mean, a few years down the road, things have been going okay. You've made some good decisions, clearly. Should you expand? Should you open a second location, extend the services you offer, go into partnership with these other guys, hire more staff, invest in more material goods, and so on? And the conditions keep changing, right? And the questions keep coming. You get a headache from thinking about this. There's a lot to think about and your success depends on the quality of judgment. Bad decisions can really hurt. The lesson: intellectual freedom to explore and find out everything you need to know to make good decisions. Intellectual freedom is valuable not only so that you can express political dissent or write the poems that you want or practice the religion of your choice. It's important for leading your life in every sphere, your work life, pursuing material well-being, as well as your personal life, your spiritual well-being. Now, Atlas Shrugged provides a masterful illustration of this. Its theme is that the mind is the motor of human life, of creativity. It generates the production of values, of goods and services, of life. We can't live unless we think, and think rationally. Other organisms can. They don't have the capacity to engage in higher conceptual level thought, and they don't need it. Instead, they're equipped with other talents, with abilities that suit them to survive. They've got the fangs or the claws or the speed or the especially keen hearing or vision. But men need the mind beyond the five senses. Good thinking is what's behind all the products and services that we use every day. It has been ever thus. From the most primitive tools, the bow and arrow, a hammer, a wheel, to the cars and the aircraft that brought us here. I don't think anybody walked. If you don't live in Cleveland, did anybody walk here? I mean, we probably got here through something that somebody had to think about, too, right? The air conditioning that we get at the touch of a button, the computers on which I composed this and sent it to myself and all that, the combination of eyeglasses of this sort and that sort and contact lenses that correct for my extremely nearsighted and farsighted vision, not a problem. Why? Because of good thinking. Good thinking makes for good living. The mind is what gives us everything good. The medicines by which we manage our diabetes, our blood pressure, the microwave ovens and their easy to overlook conveniences, right? Post-it notes, the remote control, or personal favorite, the mute button. Genius, genius. I love the mute button. Oh, I do love that mute button. In other words, on just a little reflection, it's easy to see that freedom of thought is central to material well-being, so that people can figure out how to build a better mousetrap, more labor-saving devices, more efficient uses of energy, of purifying the water, eliminating the bacteria from the food, and the rest. Answering these practical challenges requires the free flow of ideas, airing different opinions, different possibilities, alternative hypotheses, questions, challenges, the airing of doubts. But what about X? Oh, but here's why I think you're wrong, all right? We need the oxygen of free thought in order to learn the truth on issues. What's what? And what's worthwhile action? What will it be ultimately fruitful to do? Okay. Consider Atlas once again. What happens to Danconia Copper when Francisco leaves it, the thinker behind its operation? What happens to life when the men of the mind go on strike, withdraw their mental work? Is it just intellectual life that suffers? Less literature, right? Fewer poets or magazines or newspapers? Theoretical physics slows down? No, the vegetables rot. The transportation system grinds to a halt, and the lights go out. They're thrust back to adopt the primitive means of doing, primitive means of doing things, the horse and buggy. Lower levels of thinking entail lower standards of living. Without our minds working rationally, we live like beasts. And without freedom, the mind can't work rationally. All the physical force in the world can't make a man think rational thoughts. Witness in Atlas the looter's attempt to have Galt solve the crisis, right? I order you, at gunpoint, under torture, solve it. Good luck with that. You can't force a mind. I noted earlier that my words or thoughts can't twist your arm. Equally, my guns and clubs and physical pressures can only twist your arm, right? A human mind can only function when it is free. Man's mind, his ideas, are the font of everything that is truly beneficial for him. Business thrives on freedom of inquiry. We all do. Business needs freedom of inquiry because life needs it. It needs rational thought. But we can't engage in rational thought if we aren't free to think, to consider all points of view, to assess, to make mistakes, to revise. That's what the First Amendment blessedly holds sacred: freedom to think, intellectual freedom. Intellectual activity, including speech, developing, sharing ideas, is singularly important to human prosperity, to our flourishing. This is why societies with repressed ideas have historically much lower standards of living. So in this respect, free speech seems special. It's the sine qua non of life-furthering action. And this is part 6, if you're following on the handout. And people will often say things to this effect. They'll say, you know, we need free speech to affect political change. Free speech is special. That's the general idea here, right? People will often say that kind of thing. They'll say, we need free speech to affect political change or to criticize our governments, to pressure them, to hold them accountable, to campaign for unpopular causes that sometimes really are good causes, right? Like, rights for former slaves and so on, right? So a lot of people will say, yeah, free speech is especially important for that reason. It's special. But at the same time, the right to free speech isn't special. I mean, this is me talking now. I'm saying it's not really special, the right to free speech. Now, this is a little bit subtle. Intellectual activity is, but intellectual freedom, not exactly. Let me try to explain. This is a somewhat subtle point, but I think it's a really important point. All freedom is one. All rights are a unified whole. And there are a few significant aspects to this. When you violate one exercise of a person's rights or one type of exercise, you attack them all because you attack that person's sovereignty, his authority to rule his life. For instance, if I can't spend my money as I like, then I can't think as I like or speak as I like. I'd wanted to spend my money to advertise my business or to explain my opinion on immigration or to support this gubernatorial candidate. But because of the restrictions on spending, I'm prevented from doing that. By the same token, if I am not free to think, if there are restrictions on what I may read or print or publish, or with whom I may study or what conferences I may attend, if I must be confined to the narrow corridors of government-approved information, that will naturally inhibit the ideas that I'm likely to come up with about what's worth doing, how to act. Material freedom and intellectual freedom are two sides of the same coin. You could not truly, fully have either without the other. Indeed, these labels, material freedom, intellectual freedom, the labels simply call attention to different forms of exercising the core right to control your choices and actions. The freedom to lead your life as you like. Consider a passage from Cato's Letters, and this is the final thing on the front page of your handout. Cato's Letters, early 18th century. Let me read the passage. Without freedom of thought, there can be no such thing as wisdom, and no such thing as public liberty without freedom of speech. This sacred privilege is so essential to free government that the security of property and the freedom of speech always go together. And in those wretched countries where a man cannot call his tongue his own, he can scarce call anything else his own. That's pretty nice, isn't that? That's nice. But you have to ask, really? Eloquent, but I mean, is this over-egging the pudding a little bit? Is this overstated? But let's think about it. Suppose you may speak, advocate certain ideas, but not put them into practice, right? You have an idea for some invention, but you're prevented from building it. You have an idea for a song, a poem, a play, but you may not record it, perform it, circulate it. What good does the freedom to think it, or even say it, do if you can't realize it in physical form? Love them, but don't sleep with them, because we restrict your physical activities, right? Judge him the best candidate, but you can't vote for him. In matters of religion, consider him the one true God, but don't engage in the rituals of that faith, its ceremonies, its sacraments. I think this last example shows how it becomes difficult even to maintain the difference between the intellectual and the physical, right? To carve out such discrete territories. Where would religious freedom fall, right? Intellectual or physical? Well, religion, usually a matter of belief, but very often alongside associated practices of worship, of good works, of penance or pilgrimage or missionary activities. Also consider the reverse. And again, we're still just trying to really see if the Cato's letters was right in this bold connection it was claiming. But obviously you see where I'm going with this. Yes, indeed they were. Consider the reverse, right? Suppose government respects your freedom of physical activities, but not intellectual. Property we protect. Physical actions, travel, trade, commerce, smoke pot, eat all the fried food you like, have sex with whomever, all that's respected as your right. But your intellectual activities will be restricted. We'll dictate what you can read, what ideas you can be exposed to, what you can say, what opinions you can share, debate with others. The natural question, won't that take a toll on what you can do, on your actions, in traveling, trading, consuming, relations with other people, right? Human beings act on the basis of what they believe. When the government restricts what you may believe, it restricts your actions. Our existential condition arises largely from our intellectual conclusions. From what we think is so, from what we think is real, important, valuable. If the government restricts what we can entertain in that realm, it restricts our actions. It restricts our material well-being. So the upshot is, it's impossible to sever intellectual and material affairs. If I can't act on what I think, what's the point of thinking? And if I can't inform my actions by my thoughts, my conclusions, unhindered by your restrictions on what I may think, how valuable are my actions likely to be? Now, to complete my thought that all rights are one, as I put it a few minutes ago, let's return to another point that I made earlier. Your rights entitle you to lead your life however you please, because your life is yours. It doesn't belong to the state, the philosopher kings, the community. It's not for the parish priest or the wise elders or the expert nudgers in the capital to command who you marry, what work you pursue, what you eat and drink, and so on. Rights, the idea of rights, declares, do as you will, as long as you respect others' rights. Accordingly, to say that all freedom is one is to deny that some exercises of your rights are more yours, more rights than others, and more worthy of legal protection. And that's the part that's really important here, right? If your life is recognized as yours, then whatever you do with it, as long as you respect others' rights, whatever you do with it is yours to do by right. Now, this doesn't mean we can't criticize what you do, or that we shouldn't criticize what you do. Often we should, and often our criticisms will be valid, justified, correct. The morality of how people exercise their rights is a further question and a really important question for many purposes, but not for the government. That's not the lens through which the government is to view people's activities. Remember, its job, its function, is exclusively to protect your rights, not to pass judgment on how you use them, and not to seize some of them back and give them back to you only if you satisfy their moral values. We will protect your rights as long as you use them as we approve. No. Again, those are rights on a leash, which are not truly rights. That's the utilitarian framework rearing its head again. Okay. Correspondingly, though, it's not the case that the right to free speech should be more important in the law than any other right, than the right to contract, trade, travel, what have you. Nor the reverse, that some of those other, quote, material rights are more important than the right of free speech. No, all rights are equally entitled to respect and protection from the government. And it's especially important to appreciate that all rights are one in order to defend economic rights. As you well know, in this country, in the U.S., for at least 100 years now, economic rights have been scorned as second-class citizens. In the eyes of the intelligentsia and in decisions of the judiciary, decade after decade from the early 20th century, commercial speech is given less legal protection as a matter of course. This isn't like a secret or anything. I mean, they're quite bold and explicit about this. The very term, I mean, justices, Supreme Court justices, among many others, right, are completely open about it. No, commercial speech, that's down here, right? The very term tends to be spit more than said, dripping with venom, you know, commercial speech. Business interests are subordinated to community interest, consumer rights. But the very idea that some of your rights are more rights, that itself, that idea that some are more your rights or deserve more legal protection, that idea itself is an assault on your freedom. It's a denial of your sovereignty. When the state restricts your intellectual activities, it indirectly limits your physical actions because they won't be informed by your thinking. You won't take actions that you would have had you known X, had you been aware of Y, had you had a chance to think about Z. Information, ideas, beliefs inform our choices of what to do. And again, by the same token, when the state limits your physical activities, it neuters your mind. You had decided to do X, you thought about it, you reached a conclusion. But if the government blocks your physical action, it prevents you from putting your beliefs into practice, from acting on your thoughts. So the point is, you block either one, physical activity, intellectual activity, you also impede the other. So I hope you get what I was saying there. Again, intellectual activity, uniquely important to human survival. But the right to intellectual freedom is no more your right than your right to goof off or do anything else. Okay, rights are all on a par. We can talk about that more in the question period if you like. But we are actually going to conclude. A few points in conclusion, some by way of just reminders and re-hitting some of the essentials, but not all. First, on why this matters. It's important to understand the relationship between economic liberty and speech liberty, in part, to understand the unified nature of freedom and the fact that you are either respected as sovereign over your life or you aren't. And in part, it's important to appreciate all that is at stake in these disputes about freedom of speech. The prize that the First Amendment safeguards is not simply freedom of speech, it is intellectual freedom more broadly, as we said, freedom of thought. And again, it protects that for two principal reasons. Because intellectual activity as such poses no threat to others' freedom. And because of the unique and indispensable value of the mind to human well-being. And to even tighten that connection, let me put that a little bit differently. The value of the mind is the reason to respect freedom. That's why freedom is good, because the mind needs it. All right, so the value of the mind, that's the reason to respect freedom. And freedom is not threatened by another person's intellectual activities, insofar as they are simply intellectual activities. Again, so those are the two main pieces underneath the sense of the First Amendment, treating intellectual activities as, whoa, government, don't go there, okay? And this bridges us back to economic issues, free trade, free markets, property. Man survives by his wits. We outsmart other animals and our stubbornly finite quantities of land and water and minerals. Reason is man's means of survival and of prospering. Freedom is reason's precondition. When you quell speech, you quell thought. The possibility of people's coming up with rational ideas that can create life-serving values. When you quell thought, in turn, you quell progress. You suffocate life. And our lives, yours and mine, in every dimension, suffer the hit. Thank you. Wonderful. We have a lot of time for questions. Yes?
There are some expressions of free speech whose primary goal is to deny the rights of others.
I'm sorry, did you say some advocates of free speech whose primary...
Expressions.
Some expressions of free speech. Okay, go ahead.
Where the goal is to deny the rights of others. And I'm not thinking of someone who stands on a street corner that says, grab a 2x4, let's go beat up all of those X, whatever that group is.
Right.
I'm talking about something which I think is a more subtle. People who deny the human status of a particular group. This has been done historically. Today it's maybe the Klan or neo-Nazis saying, you know, we don't like them. And you know what? They're not real people.
Oh, of course.
The Nazis did that in...
Sure.
With the film The Eternal Jew, they spliced in footage of rats and vermin.
Right. No, I mean, there are people who exercise their right of free speech to say things that are false or worse, okay?
And that, yeah. If someone accepted that, would validate saying, no, you know, I don't negotiate with rats and vermin. If I have a disagreement, you exterminate them. I don't negotiate with whatever, you know.
Right.
And they would say, they're not people. We can do what we have to, do what we want.
Right.
Is there any justification for placing limits on that kind of expression?
No. Now let me explain, if I understand you correctly. No, meaning false ideas. It's really important that an idea is false. I mean, that's an important fact to learn about a given idea. That it is false, okay? But the sheer fact that some idea is false is not grounds for restricting or silencing that idea. The only way to reach truth on it, I mean, we're not born knowing everything, and we're not born infallible. We have to figure it out. And how do we figure out? By trial, error, by hearing ideas, by entertaining ideas and thinking and trying to corroborate by evidence and observation what's true and what's false. So it would be antithetical to the whole idea of freedom of speech and the reason why we need freedom of speech, which is so that we can reason, to declare, we have reached X conclusion, therefore any ideas that challenge that should not be accepted. Now again, I'm leaving aside certain other kinds of cases that are a little bit more complicated, you know, when there would actually be an infringement of someone's rights, but you're free to insult me personally in all sorts of ways, and you should be legally free to do that. Let me go, there's a fair amount of questions, so let me go on and we can come back further, maybe, okay? Thanks.
Hi. My question is around your freedom around the area of being listened to, because we now live in a time where, other than people, we also have algorithms listening to us.
We have, algorithms.
Algorithms listening to us. Not only listening to us, but also, you know, measuring pupil dilations, recording emails, photographs, etc., which I'm sure we signed up for when we clicked on the terms and conditions, but they hold on to it for a period of time. Like Facebook has legally has the rights to hold on to your information for 50 years. What that means is they have a memory of 50 years that you have to deal with. And what it also means is that there's 50 years of time for someone to compromise that information, from one of their servers. So I keep wondering if you really do have freedom of speech and freedom of thought if you have to always also deal with the anxiety of who or what may be parsing through your thoughts or through your speech.
I think that's a complicated issue, and I haven't thought it fully through, so I'll just give you a few quick observations that are relevant to it, okay? But like many of you, I've clicked lots of those things, you know, because you just want what you want when you want it online, right? So I've clicked through many of things. I have suffered no anxiety about, oh my God, they're watching me for 50 years. I mean, like, I just, you know, I think one thing we need, it's like, are we really suffering from that sort of anxiety? Now, at the same time, I mean, I was just reading a little bit in today's Wall Street Journal about the latest revelations of the NSA or whatever it's called, and that they've gotten, again, I mean, the government here, right? I didn't agree government take all this information from me, but now they've got all this information. There were, again, some lapses, and they were getting more information than they were supposed to on certain purposes. So I don't mean I'm blasé about anybody knowing anything, okay, but I mean, there are differences between what we agree to and not. I think one of the crucial things that we really have to go at in depth in really thinking this issue through as you raise the question is, you asked something toward the end like, are you really free if you have to worry about this stuff? Let's really be careful about what we mean by freedom. Freedom isn't the ability to do what I like or say what I like or share what I like, subject only to the conditions that I'm comfortable with, like, ooh, but it makes me uncomfortable if they know that. I mean, that's reason for me to be very careful about what I agree to, and if I am more sensitive about other people knowing things about me or being able to, you know, extend to know that information far into the future, then I ought to be more careful about what I agree to, okay? But we want to be careful that we're not, and this happens so often in the contemporary discourse about freedom, we use freedom equivocally to mean two or three or 10 different things, and freedom, the kind of freedom you have a right to, and that the law should protect you in the possession of, is freedom from others' initiation of force. So we'd really have to look at what you're calling freedom in there, and is it really the relevant kind of freedom, okay? But I will say, there are all, you know, there's a kind of host of privacy-related issues, some of which really are related to free speech issues, and that's simply an area that I haven't gone into deeply enough in my thinking. So I do think there are some hard questions there, too. I don't in any way mean to be dismissive of this area or say that it's simply rectified by, be careful before you click. I mean, I think people often do need, but I don't think, oh, that's the solution to the whole thing, or the other things I said. Okay.
With regard to all freedom being one, I've long thought that the concept of religious liberty is invalid as a false division on the basis of a non-essential characteristic, the motivation behind an action. And I'm wondering, first, would you agree with that? And second, do you have any thoughts on the correct or rational basis for narrowings down to more specific rights like freedom of speech or assembly or association?
Oh, I love that question. I could jump up and down. I have a lot to say on it and a lot more than you want to hear, but I'll just say a little bit for now. And famous last words, I'll say a little bit. You've heard that before. I don't think religious liberty is a bogus or invalid concept. I think it is often misunderstood and misapplied in contemporary law, and maybe not only in contemporary law, okay? I think it's fair to refer to religious liberty as it is to lots of kinds of liberty, only in the sense that they're specifying the particular kinds of exercise of one's broader freedom, you know, to lead one's own life as one's like. And oh, you want to do that in a religious way or by these practices, just as we can talk of freedom of property or freedom of travel or freedom of speech. Well, he's speaking, writing, and so on now. So I think it's a perfectly okay concept, okay? And it named something that was very real and on the minds of the founders, given a lot of religious persecution, given that a lot of them still believed in different gods and had been, you know, religious persecution was very real and alive to them, okay? What's happened in recent years, and I have written, so on the handout, there are some of my own writings on there, and I give you a list of a few things that are on the First Amendment. So two of them are on religious freedom, and two of them are on speech freedom. And one of the pieces on religious freedom is particularly concerned with the question of religious exemptions in the law. I have no truck with those. I'm very critical of those in that article. I think that represents a misunderstanding and misapplication of what religious freedom is, because it's not that religious freedom, that religious people should get any more rights, right? No, it just means your rights are no less or no more based on the religion that you practice. And there, I mean, we have Madison and Jefferson and those guys on record as saying that, indicating that that's what they had in mind, okay? So I'm very critical of that, and I have to stop myself from going on too long about that. But that's, I mean, I think it's a hard issue in some ways because we are often very sympathetic with the religious, I think objectivists, and I am very sympathetic with the religious people who want to get out from under the over, you know, the oppressive government. We think, yeah, you shouldn't have to provide these services for your employees, but nobody should. And you shouldn't have to be religious to get out of that obligation. Okay, so that's the kind of thing I talk at in the piece on religious freedom. Let me also, though, while we're in the vicinity of religious freedom, put in a plug for my other article, which, because that one, the one on what good is religious freedom, and Rand is even in the title, there are a few good I don't mean there are just a few good pages in there, but there are a few pages on that that are very good for this issue of forcing a mind. Like, so there, it's not just religion centric, that article. So even though it's about religious freedom, it's really about intellectual freedom more broadly. So some of the kind of material that came up in this discussion is in that article as well. But I'll also take a chance here to plug something I haven't yet read. But that is in the new Foundations of Freedom book that Robert Mayhew and Greg Salmieri edited. I think there's like 100 or so pages by Darrell Wright. Having read previous versions of that work on force and freedom, having both heard some early lectures and then read some previous versions, I think that's going to be dynamite in terms of penetrating the nature of force and freedom in the mind and the needs there that are really the foundations that need to be understood to understand then the applications. So that was me being brief. Good luck. Okay. We got 2 minutes left. Where are we? Okay.
I used to think that libel and slander are legitimate restrictions on free speech because they could be injurious to someone's financial status. And then I read that some construction contractor sued a woman for giving him a negative review on Angie's List, and like lawsuit for, I don't know, $120,000 or something. And that's when I realized that it could have a chilling effect on free speech. So what do you think about that?
That's a really interesting question. And I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know the ins and outs of libel and slander law. I don't know much about libel and slander law at all. But I do think they're completely valid categories. And the kind of example that you cite is probably a misapplication of those. And it's really important that we not confuse mistaken judgments about proper laws, that we not take them as, oh, you see, that law was ill-conceived in the first place. No, it really often is the application that's mistaken. So libel and slander, you know, I think you've got to prove that there was a knowing, deliberate misrepresentation of another person in a certain way that did lead to the loss of property or material damage or something. But simply giving a negative review does not do that. I mean, it may not hit any of those boxes or check any of those boxes in terms of being, you know, it could be my honest opinion that the food or the service was crummy or whatever, right? And yeah, maybe that'll affect some people, but there's a difference to what you're purporting as a matter of taste, a matter of opinion. We all know we have different tastes in these sorts of things, right? Versus, you know, their kitchen is infested with these sorts of vermin and so on. Okay, but I think in a way it's similar to the religion case. Freedom of religion, perfectly valid, right? But the fact that there are some misapplications of it, that fact does not indict the concept. So hold on to your, you know, there are, again, these legitimate case, things like libel and slander law and a few others of the sort that I referred to, reckless endangerment and so on, when there are certain special circumstances, do legitimate silencing that person from speaking in such a way that it would infringe on the other person's rights. Okay, so I hope that makes some sense. Sure.
Will you share some of your thoughts as a legal scholar? Where do you draw the line? When does a call for violence... When does a call for violence become an initiation of force and no longer a matter of free speech? Kind of a gray line when...
Yeah, well, I don't... I, I'm not sure I would say it's a gray line, I think, but maybe, anyway, that's not the issue. I don't know exactly, I don't know precisely, right? But in broader terms, right, there's a difference between we should have a very different kind of government, and, you know, here are the brick, I mean, depending on what, whether you're in Washington or you're in a small society and so on, something like incitement to violence or incitement to take up arms and really in an imminent way making very all the more immediate and real, and here's how to do it, and we're going to do it. I mean, one example I sometimes use is think about some of the abortion debates and debates about abortion doctors and so on, right? It's one thing to advocate and have rallies and rile people up to, we really need to, just think about the people who want to roll back Roe v. Wade and so on. We should really, these people saying we should really change the abortion laws in this country and so on. Perfectly free to advocate that, okay? Not free to say, okay, and this is Dr. So-and-so, and he lives at 202 Elm Street, and he's going to be home at 7 o'clock tonight, and here are the bricks to throw through the window, or that kind of thing. So I can't give you the exact particulars here, and some lawyers out there maybe just in terms of current law and have some more, they would have more knowledge of current law about where some of these lines are drawn, gotcha, and they would also probably have more thoughts based on seeing how it's played out in law than I do, so I really can't help. But I will say this. Let's not let the further details that people more knowledgeable about law and philosophical about law could fill in, let's not keep, I can't say it, you can't say it, from thinking there isn't a big difference between the general advocacy of all sorts of ideas and the advocacy of going after these people's rights now. Something like that is what I would really keep in mind. Okay.
Would you consider it a violation of the First Amendment if the government doesn't if the government doesn't act when people are confronted by threats of force if they speak? For instance, if a certain speaker's coming to campus and a group is threatening to riot if they come, and the cops just stand back and let them set fires at Berkeley and so forth.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not in law enforcement, right? But yeah, the government has a responsibility to assess threats. And, when there's a real, credible threat, evidence that this is real and credible and likely to transpire or something, against a speaker or anything like that, then it is the responsibility of the government to step in. Now, again, not being in law enforcement, they've always got to figure out, the distribution of their resources. But yeah, I would think it's among their responsibilities to protect people when there's good reason to think they've been threatened, in ways that are going to come to fruition if they don't act. And they... what we see sometimes is cowardice on the part of police departments, or sometimes it's the security agencies at a university, right? Cowardice in the name of not being seen or perceived in a certain repressive way and so on. You have a job to do. If you don't want to do that job, don't do the damn job, right? But you have a job to protect people, and regardless of who the speaker is and what position he's advocating, right? If he legitimately has a right to speak there before those people that night, and his rights are being truly jeopardized by the kinds of intelligence that you have about what's going on, then by all means, those people should be kept out. And it's a dereliction of their duty to play political games in deciding how they will use their resources, I would think.
The freest economy in the world is Singapore. But when it comes to freedom of speech, they're not in the top half, probably not. They're probably in the bottom 25%. Do you have any thoughts on their ability to maintain such a free economy and such a restrictive free speech?
So I'll give you the cute answer. Check back with me in 70 years. But that's a... So what I'm trying to get at, and I think that's a... That's a good question. I mean, that's a good logical question. There are other societies as well where you think, gee, they don't have much freedom of speech, but they seem to be doing okay, materially, and so on, right? There are a few different things one can say here. It's not sustainable. Because, that is, when you shut off people's minds, you are shutting off the pipeline of the kinds of ideas that fuel material progress. You are arresting the development of a society when you arrest their ideas, right? How long it takes, how slow or fast the decline will be, may vary depending on a variety of circumstances, right? But an obedience society, right? A repeat after me society, those sorts of societies, right? Well, they can't go anywhere forward. They can't truly move forward. The best they can do is what they can do according to the ideas that have been thought before, or that they have been allowed to turn into some material produce or something like that. So it's just not sustainable given the needs, you know, for progress. It's a society of regress. It fates itself to regress. Again, the regression can be faster or shorter, but you choke the mind, you choke the ability to adapt, to go further ahead, and to maintain, even to maintain what you have. That's the sort of thing I would say there. I hope I'm looking at the right, I'm looking at somebody there, and then it's like, that might not even be the right guy, so anyway. Hi.
Next guy. Quick follow-up on the issue of libel laws. Accepting the validity of such laws and, you know, limiting speech of such nature, I think it's important. I think this was might have been tacitly implied that, okay, you know, in case of, you know, libel, we have to limit free speech. My point is, no, this is a false application of principle of free speech. We are not limiting free speech. We're limiting speech.
Beautiful. Right? Go ahead. So, go so, for so it.
We still,
you go.
We still right. maintain fully 100% free speech principle, and libel laws are not limitation on that principle. This is just a wrong application, you know, that we're, you know, limiting free speech. We're limiting speech, right?
Mm-hmm. No, I agree, and I think this is an important point that's often misunderstood. Freedom of speech and speech are not identical concepts. One way that I think of it is this. Speech, that word, speech, refers to all the things that you're capable of saying. And among the things I'm capable of saying are, you know, telling lies or fraudulently misrepresenting the products I'm selling, right? I'm capable of saying all sorts of things, nice things, nasty things, rights infringing things, rights respecting things, and so on. My right to speech or my freedom of speech refers to that subset of all the things that I'm capable of saying. The subset, which itself is pretty huge, but it's not just the same as all the things I'm capable of saying. Freedom of speech refers to that subset of things that I am perfectly entitled to say, because in saying them, I'm not infringing on anybody else's rights. But people are very sloppy, and they use the term speech and freedom of speech interchangeably, and then they think, well, you see, if we can silence your speech that would be libelous, ah, that's an exception. Ah, the right isn't absolute. No, 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 no. The right to free speech is absolute. If it's properly understood what its domain is, all of the speech that you are capable of engaging in, that doesn't infringe on anybody else's rights or freedom, right? You are perfectly, absolutely entitled to that. And then, so speech is the broader category. And again, if you're interested, so one of the articles on the handout, it's called The Free Speech Vernacular. It goes into four concepts used in free speech debates that are often misunderstood. Censorship, freedom, absolute, and exception. And I think those last two, absolutes and exceptions, are often confused, even by the best of the defenders of freedom of speech, and their real dangers and destruction from the misunderstanding and misapplication of those concepts. So if you want to see this developed a little bit more carefully, you can see it in that article. But thank you not only for a good question, but I think such, if I may, such an intelligent observation that's so rare these days, you know, so thank you.
There's a serious question under what I'm going to ask you.
Yeah.
Do you think we should refrain or restrain Yaron Brook when he calls for revolution?
Should we what or restrain him?
Restrain him. No, I said refrain, but I didn't mean
that. Oh, okay. Should we restrain him? No, but he's not, you know, he's not, even he won't say, let's shoot so-and-so, you know, or, yeah.
So he's,
no.
He's
actually, he represents all the reasons why we need, I mean, God, yeah.
Yes.
We need freedom of speech, and we need to be able to talk about these ideas, and we need to be able to read Marx, and we need to be able to read Bernie Sanders so that people can figure out and understand what's what. We need to be able to read history, real history. Anyway, yeah. Hi.
Because we have rights and they cannot be taken away by others, it also stands that we couldn't give them up ourselves and sell ourselves to slavery, for example. So at what point does the government's job of protecting rights, where's the line between them protecting rights and a kind of paternalism?
Okay, the line between the government protecting our rights and paternalism. Okay, paternalism in regard to the government has always been understood as the government interfering with your rights, abridging your rights, for the sake of, you know, or under the pretense of, or perhaps not pretense, but under the intention of, we're going to take better care of you. We'll restrict your freedom. We will, truly what it means is, we'll violate your rights, but we're doing so for your own good. Now, that can be completely well-intentioned. It can be ill-intentioned, but intentions aren't the issue. Either way, right? Whether it's the benevolent, the truly benevolent, well-meaning dictator, or some other kind of dictator, right? It's the dictation that's wrong. It's the, no, it's my life. But, I mean, sadly, we've had so much paternalism in different forms of government policy in this country and many others for many, many decades now that people get kind of used to it. And they kind of like it. And they don't call it for what it is. And when Cass Sunstein comes along 10 or 15 years ago talking about libertarian paternalism, we all just go along and think that's fine. And with freedom of speech and a lot of these utilitarian arguments that I was referring to at the beginning, what you get is cognitive paternalism. Well, we can't let them read that. That's not good for them. They better not read that Yaron Brook or those objectivist people or those people who say things about race that aren't kosher and so on, right? So really, I mean, we have creeping cognitive paternalism. And if you want to turn it up one better, we now have some extremely highly respected, I'm thinking of one person in particular, philosophers, moral philosophers who win like lifetime awards and all, calling for the government to manipulate our emotions. Political Emotions is a book that talks about, well, the government should really try to foster certain emotions in people because these are most useful to the benefit of society. So paternalism and protecting rights is not in any way paternalism, all right? It's we need something, we want something to protect our freedom, only to protect our freedom, to make our own decisions, make our own choices, lead our own lives, get along in a way such that we can all flourish. Okay.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Tara, for your lecture.
Thanks.
And that answer to that last question leads into what I was hoping you'd say a little more about. As you were talking about this, it struck me that the utilitarian approach that is one of the ways that people defend free speech has also kind of gotten aggravated by the wrong approach to defending liberty.
I missed a few words in there.
Yeah, sorry. So you mentioned the two different ways that free speech has been defended,
right?
Utilitarianism and the liberty approach. And it seems to me the mistake that we're not protecting against the initiation of physical force, we're trying to prevent violence. That conceptual switch has actually aggravated this because people think that words do hurt them because they get upset by the words, and it's how they feel is, you know, that you're actually harming them by making them feel bad.
Right.
And now I'm hearing that there's actually a book on political emotions. Could you talk some more about how the wrong view of rights is actually permitting this wildly subjectivist view of what harm is.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting question. And I think it just, I don't really have a good answer, but it goes to the issue of if you don't define your terms, if you don't, so, and I mean, a couple of things here. There's if you don't define your terms, but even more specifically, if you don't get the essentials right on an issue and stick to those essentials and understand it. So this even in my response to one of the earlier questions about, well, we really need to be careful about what we mean by freedom here, because once that gets out of, no, freedom means this. Rights are rights against others' initiation of force, not against anything else, and so on. You've got to be so disciplined in the use of your concepts. I mean, the first thing is you have to properly come to understand what does that really mean? Not simply define your terms like, well, what do I mean by it? What do I decide or declare to mean by it? It's like, what is it? What's the phenomenon there? The nature of freedom, the nature of force, the kind of harm that is relevant to rights infringements and isn't. And this, again, is where a lot of utilitarians, the people who go with the John Stuart Mill thing, you know, one of his, in On Liberty, where he has this discussion of freedom of thought and makes a lot of really good, true, valid points about freedom of thought and its value, okay? But again, the ultimate justification is wrong. But similarly, in that book, he has the famous harm principle, which says government in general, not just on speech or intellectual issues, right? The government is to prevent harm to others or something like that, prevent you from doing harm to others. And libertarians love it and they lap it up. And harm is this capacious category that opens the way, that they don't define properly as, well, what aspects of harm are relevant to the issues that the government should care about, namely the protection of rights, right? That's the only kind of harm that the government has business caring about is the harm I suffer when somebody violates my freedom or my rights, right? But if you don't get that right from the outset and then be extremely disciplined in making sure that that's what's at stake in all of these different debates, you get this, I'm harmed because I'm disrespected or I'm not dignified. So again, sorry, but my latest article talks about the difference between, if you're interested in these issues, you know, it talks about the difference between speech and action, and one of the kinds of arguments that I address directly is this claim that certain speech amounts to an action that assaults me, that is truly a violence against me. Yeah, so that needs a lot of work. All right. Okay, I think we're out of time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to aynrand.org.